three headlines. Top Iranian security sources rule out the country's step-by-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the U.S. only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement warns about U.S. plots against Yemen and criticizes some regional countries for pursuing Washington's policies. Also in the headlines, the Saudi court upholds original sentence of a prominent women's rights activist despite international condemnation of the trial. Hello, welcome. Thanks for joining us. The top Iranian security official has ruled out any step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The official said that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. He said the new U.S. administration has failed to lift these sanctions and added that Tehran will further reduce its commitments if Washington retains them. The Iranian official also dismissed any official or unofficial talks with the U.S. before the sanctions are lifted. He said that Iran's defense and missile programs, as well as its regional presence, have nothing to do with the nuclear deal. Earlier on Wednesday, President Hassan Rouhani urged the U.S. to end its inaction regarding the accord.
We hope those who have violated the rules and now say they want to adhere to them show this by their actions and end the economic terrorism against Iran and stop their violations.
Rouhani said time is ripe for the full implementation of the JCPOA, if other signatories fulfill the commitments also. He reiterated that Iran will fully live up to its obligations once other parties do so. However, he said that Iran's measures will be proportional. The U.S. walked out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and reinstated tough sanctions on Iran under former President Donald Trump. The new U.S. administration has signaled its readiness to re-enter the agreement, but wants Iran first to return to full compliance. Commentator John Stepling says that Iran's sense of the U.S. indecisiveness regarding the nuclear deal is justified.
I think Iran is probably justified in taking a pretty hard-line stance here. There's no indication so far in Biden's administration that his foreign policy will deviate from the previous six presidents or seven presidents. I don't think that Biden's administration is opposed to, you know, returning to the JCPOA. And frankly, for the U.S. And the Biden team, this is not a front burner issue. I just don't think they're going to take decisive action right now.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has accused the U.S. of hatching a plot to target his country, just like it did with Iraq and Afghanistan. Abdelmalek Bedreddin al-Houthi said that Washington wants to exploit Yemeni people and resources, as well as take control of his strategic position. He also slammed Israel and the West for propagating the Takfiri terrorism with the aim of gaining control in the region. Al-Houthi underlined that some regional countries are willfully accepting U.S. hegemony. He warned that surrendering to Washington means becoming slaves to it. The Ansarullah leader said the U.S. is using its military bases to extend its domination and to advance its regional agenda. He was speaking on the martyrdom anniversary of Hossein Badreddin al-Houthi, a former Ansarullah leader. Hundreds of health facilities across Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and the lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion has warned that it can no longer store blood stocks. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali, has more.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeida and LBB have stopped their operations and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country.
International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Saudi court has upheld the original sentence given to women's rights activist Lujain Al-Hathloul, despite international condemnation against her jailing. Hathloul was sentenced in December 2018 to nearly 6 years in prison after a lengthy trial, but she was released last month, having served half of her custodial sentence. She appeared in the court to appeal against remaining restrictions, including a five-year travel ban following her release. The 31-year-old was detained in May 2018 for voicing against the ban on women's driving and her opposition to male guardianship system. UN rights experts had described the terrorism charges brought against her as spurious. Hathloul's release followed a request of Riyadh from the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. The Biden administration has taken a tough stance on the kingdom and is facing growing criticism for its clampdown on dissent. Human rights groups have accused Bahraini forces of torturing children arrested last month in connection with protests marking the 2011 uprising anniversary. In a joint statement, Human Rights Watch and Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy said the detained children were also threatened with rape and electric shocks. They blamed the kingdom's prosecutors and judges for enabling such abuses. The statement said the police and prosecutors refused to allow parents or defense lawyers to be present during their interrogations. According to the rights groups, judges also unnecessarily ordered their detention. They said four children are being tried as adults, including a 16-year-old with serious health problems. Bahrain's popular uprising began in February 2011. However, the Al-Khalifa regime has cracked down on the protests, arresting, injuring, and killing many demonstrators. Saeed Shafi is a political analyst who joins us. Well, the anniversary is something that was marked, and here you have this report. Do you think that this system is still intimidated by the protests, given the fact that they're continuing with their detainments, with their interrogations, and forced confessions?
Thank you very much. It is clear that the regime is very sensitive to the idea of public expression of opinion. They don't want to hear anybody asking for anything. We are in charge. We are the rulers. You have no right to ask to ask or to call or to express an opinion. Now, these children are part of the society who has risen against this dictatorial regime. And now we see that they have rounded up many people, mostly children, but also others. The fathers of the martyrs who were remembering their loved ones on the day they were killed 10 years ago were also taken into custody, including the father of the first martyr of the revolution on the 14th February 2011. So we are dealing with a regime that has absolutely no bounds, no constitutional reference, no ethical or moral stance, and it is just torture upon torture upon torture until they think they bring everybody to their knees. That's not going to happen. The people are not going to on their knees. They are still there, and they will continue to challenge this dictatorship until they achieve what they want.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Saeed Shafi, political analyst there. Many thanks. Moving on, South Korea has agreed to increase its funding for U.S. troops stationed in the country by nearly 14% this year. In our news review program, we discuss this issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
South Korea says it has agreed to increase its funding for U.S. military troops stationed in the country by nearly 14%. Under a new deal, South Korea will pay more than $1 billion for hosting some 28,000 500 U.S. service members this year. That's the biggest annual rise in nearly two decades, South Korea's foreign ministry says. The increase in the contribution reaffirms the need for a stable deployment of U.S. forces in the country. The rise is part of a six-year pact that replaces an expired deal. Seoul has been paying Washington for its troop presence since early 1990s. The soldiers are meant to defend South Korea against possible threats from its nuclear-armed neighbor, North Korea. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Jennifer Chang, who's joining us from Seoul. Also, we have activist and political analyst Ryan Dawson joining us from Osaka. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Jennifer in Seoul. Talk to us more about the agreement to increase funding for U.S. military troops in the country. The number has been announced as 14%. What have been the reactions as well?
Well, of course, the South Korean public is not all that happy with this huge increase in defense cost sharing. Compared to 2019, the figure has jumped 13.9% for this year. And then on top of that, there will be increases from 2022 through 2025 that are linked to the South Korean military's own spending increases for its own military outside of any alliance activities with the U.S. military. So from the South Koreans' point of view, this is a huge financial burden, and it's bound to create some tension between the U.S. and South Korean militaries. Now, negotiations have been going on now for years. Under Trump, the two sides were not able to reach an agreement, but now that Biden has taken office, the South Koreans were eager to clinch a deal with the U.S., with the new incoming Trump administration, before they got locked into further stalemates like they had with the Trump administration over defense cost sharing. Clearly, the U.S. has become more and more reluctant to pay for the defense of South Korea. The South Koreans are trying to become independent, in fact, and defend themselves against any external attacks, not just from countries in Asia, but from anywhere. They are not singling out North Korea in particular, but the U.S. is determined to continue the alliance and not let South Korea be self-sufficient when it comes to their military defense.
Ryan Dawson, what are your thoughts on this new deal, the 14% increase? That's, I guess, more than $1 billion for hosting the 28,000-plus U.S. service members. They're saying it's the biggest annual rise in nearly two decades. Why now?
Well, it's an increase across the board, not only for the U.S. troops stationed in South Korea, but on South Korea's own military-industrial complex and their own industry. South Korea has become the 10th largest arms exporter in the world. And a lot of these U.S. troops, that also benefits certain arms industries in South Korea. A lot of ammunition, guns, and service work, and entire towns built around these U.S. bases, the service and their economies depend on this. And there's a soft power politics at play here. When you give the U.S. a deal and agree to pay more for the military, then the U.S. will, in turn, loosen up trade on other means. And they are the third largest trading partner with South Korea. So there's always a deal there to be made. But South Korea often blames its military increases on the U.S. as sort of a way to divert public anger and say, well, it's America. What are you going to do about it? We have to have them here. And they're so important in trade deals, we just don't have the leverage to negotiate more with the United States. But they have slowly been increasing their own arms export industry the entire time. And you have to understand, this is a country that used to be one of the poorest countries in the world as recently as the 60s. Now they're the 11th largest economy on earth and the 10th largest arms exporter.
Mr. Dawson, the South Korean Foreign Ministry said the increase in the contribution reaffirms the need for a stable deployment of U.S. forces in the country. What do you make of those comments?
Well, what they're aiming at, and the big money maker, are war games. And this is one of the largest contingencies for North Korea. One of the U.S. and South Korea to stop doing is joint war games, because they often involve mock invasions of North Korea. Each time where you've seen arms incidents or shooting missiles into the Sea of Japan has been in reaction to these jointly conducted war games activities. And it's housing more ships, docking more U.S. boats, aircrafts, etc., more airstrips. It costs a lot, but it also means larger war games for both sides. They all get to spend a lot of money. They get to increase their budgets. It involves a lot of industry, so there's a lot of pressure on both D.C. and in Seoul to increase these events, but it just makes all of their enemies more hostile. It makes North Korea dig in deeper, and it makes them more reluctant to give up their nuclear program. And a lot of the military toys they're spending these things on, tanks and aircraft, really do nothing to block artillery, which is what's at stake, really, if there were ever an actual war with North Korea. And North Korea is tunneled in, most of it's underground. These things would be useless in such an assault, but they built them because they cost a lot of money. And as far as the exports, they're mostly sending submarines to Indonesia. It's really unrelated to the defense of the country. It's just related to defense spending. And that's what's driving the U.S. and South Korea. It's pretty typical anywhere you look in the world.
Thanks a lot. Jennifer Press TV's Jennifer Chang joining us from Seoul. Also thanks to activist and political analyst Ryan Dawson speaking to us from Osaka.
Welcome back. Several anti-coup protesters have been injured in Myanmar following clashes with security forces. The clashes broke out in the city of Yangon. Protesters scrambled to safety as gunshots were fired. The Southeast Asian nation has been in turmoil since the military overthrew the government of Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. The military complained of fraud in the November election. People across Myanmar have continued their protests on a daily basis to demand the return of civilian rule, despite violent crackdown by the military. Human rights organizations say that at least 60 protesters have been killed and 1,900 have been arrested since the coup. And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Even if U.S. President Joe Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut Guantanamo down, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its past mistakes. We now present you an article written by Ramzi Baroud, a journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. The piece is titled, Is This Who Americans Are? Gitmo is the U.S.'s Enduring Shame. The article was taken from the MintPressNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Ramzi Baroud's article. Certainly our goal and our intention. This was the non-committal answer given by the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki when, on 12th of February, she was asked by a reporter whether the new Joe Biden administration intends to shut down the notorious prison at Guantanamo Bay by the end of the president's first term in office. Jen Psaki's answer may have seemed reassuring. The untold suffering experienced by hundreds of men in this American gulag, many of whom were surely innocent, would be finally coming to an end. However, considering the history of Guantanamo and the trail of broken promises by the Barack Obama administration, the new administration's pledge is hardly reassuring or encouraging. Compare the new language with that of Obama's impassioned diatribes about humanity, justice, and American values, which he utilized whenever he spoke of Guantanamo. Barack Obama said at a speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013, Guantanamo has become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law. Enamored with his every word, Obama's audience clapped with enthusiasm. When he delivered that particular speech, Obama was then serving his second term in office. He already had ample opportunity to shut down the prison, which operated with no international monitoring and entirely outside the realms of international and U.S. laws. Barack Obama is likely to be remembered for his words, not his actions. Not only did he fail to shut down the prison, which was erected by his predecessor George W. Bush in 2002, but the Guantanamo industry continued to thrive during his term in office. For example, in his speech, Barack Obama made reference to the high cost of $150 million each year to imprison 166 people. According to the New Yorker magazine, reporting in 2016, Guantanamo's budget had morphed to $445 million last year when Barack Obama was still in office. Yet, as the budget grew by leaps and bounds, the number of Guantanamo prisoners dwindled. Currently, there are only 40 prisoners still residing in that massive edifice of metal, concrete, and barbed wire, located at the eastern tip of Cuba. Built atop a piece of land leased by the United States back in 1903. It is easy to conclude that the U.S. government keeps the prison open only to avoid international accountability, and arguably to extract information by torture, an act that is inconsistent with American laws. But this cannot be it. On the one hand, the entire wars against Afghanistan and Iraq were illegal under international law. Such a fact hardly stopped the U.S. and its allies from savagely invading, humiliating, and torturing entire populations, with no regard whatsoever to legal and moral arguments. On the other hand, Guantanamo is merely one of many American-run prisons and detention centers throughout the world that operate with no manual of rules and according to the most ruthless tactics. The tragedy of Abu Ghraib, a U.S. military detention center near Baghdad, only became famous when direct evidence of the degrading and incredibly violent conduct that was taking place within its walls was produced and publicized. In fact, many American officials and members of Congress at the time used the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004 as an opportunity to whitewash and rebrand American crimes elsewhere, and to present the misconduct in this Iraqi prison as an isolated incident involving just a few bad apples. The few bad apples argument made by George W. Bush was more or less the same logic utilized by Barack Obama when he championed the closure of Guantanamo. Indeed, both presidents insisted that neither Abu Ghraib nor Guantanamo should be made out to represent what America is really all about. Is this who we Americans are? Barack Obama animatedly and passionately asked as he made a case in favor of the closure of Guantanamo, speaking as if he was a human rights advocate, not a commander-in-chief who had direct authority to shut down the entire facility. The truth is that the Abu Ghraib tortures were not a few bad apples, and Guantanamo is indeed a microcosm of exactly what the United States is or has become. From Bagram prison in Afghanistan to Abu Ghraib in Iraq to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba to the many floating prisons, news of which was leaked by US media in 2014, the US government continues to make a mockery of international and humanitarian laws. Many American officials who genuinely advocate the closure of Guantanamo refuse to acknowledge that the prison is a symbol of this, of their country's intransigence, and refuse to accept that, like any other country in the world, it is accountable to international law. This lack of accountability has exceeded the US government's insistence to act alone, as in to launch wars against international mandates. One US administration after another has also made it clear that under no circumstances would they allow accused war criminals to be investigated, let alone stand trial, before the International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague, Netherlands. The message here is that even America's bad apples can potentially walk free, regardless of the heinous crimes that they have committed. Just months after the Trump administration imposed sanctions on International Criminal Court, ICC, judges to punish them for potential investigations of U.S. crimes in Afghanistan, it freed the convicted criminals who carried out horrific crimes in Iraq. On 22nd of December, Donald Trump pardoned four American mercenaries who belonged to the private military firm Blackwater. These convicted murderers were involved in the killing of 14 Iraqi civilians, including two Iraqi children, in Baghdad in 2007. President Joe Biden fulfills his promise of shutting down Guantanamo or not, little will change if the U.S. remains committed to its condescending attitude towards international law and to its undeserved view of itself as a country that exists above the universal rights of everyone else. That said, Guantanamo on its own is a crime against humanity, and there can never be any justification to rationalize why hundreds of people are held indefinitely without trial and without due process, without international observers, and without ever seeing their families and loved ones. The explanation often offered by the pro-Guantanamo pundits is that the prison inmates are dangerous men. If that was the case, indeed, why were these supposed criminals not allowed to see their day in court? According to a report by Amnesty International published in May of 2020, of the 779 men who were taken to that facility, only seven have been convicted. Worse, five of them were convicted as a result of pre-trial agreements under which they pleaded guilty, in return for the possibility of release from the base. According to the human rights group, such a trial by military commission did not meet fair trial standards. In other words, Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry, and a lucrative industry at that. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system. Referring to the unjust justice system, Human Rights Watch derided the U.S. for having the largest reported prison population in the world. Human Rights Watch stated on its website, "The U.S. criminal justice system, from policing and prosecution through to punishment, is plagued with injustices like racial disparities, excessively harsh sentencing, and drug and immigration policies that improperly emphasize criminalization. The above two can be considered an answer to Barack Obama's rhetorical question, is this who Americans are? Yes, Mr. Obama, in fact, this is precisely who you are." While offering the world's most miserable detention conditions to hundreds of potentially innocent men, Guantanamo also offers career opportunities, high military perks and honors, and a seemingly endless budget for a small army to guard only a few shackled, gaunt-looking men in a faraway land. So even if President Joe Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut down Guantanamo Bay, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its past mistakes.
Ocean of Dua.
أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Dear listeners, with regard to the concept of stamp, which was one of the most important elements that could be found in the texts of our ziyarat, we have mentioned some of the properties and some of the actually requirements of this. We talked about friendship and dissociation. We talked about pleasure and anger, and also peace and submission. The last of which we talked about was praying for the triumph of revenge, which was mostly reflected in the texts of ziyarat for the 12th Imam, may the Almighty Allah hasten his auspicious advent. Now, taking revenge and praying for it is part of the political stand, the stand of the family of monotheism, the family of tawheed, right from the time of Ibrahim alayhi salam, rather from the time of Noah up to this day, and the stand that we are all having right now is the same, and they are all going through one single course with a single course of action, a single point of set off, and a single goal. This stand and Mawqif extends from the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam to the time of the reappearance of Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif from the progeny of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And that's when Allah will bring to an end at his hand with victory and triumph this long journey which has been full of bloods and tears, full of victories and relapse, full of ease and adversity. This is in order that Allah the Exalted may avenge on those who bar others from his way and those who have killed, oppressed, and somehow suppressed the leaders of this path and its followers.
رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ.
The greatest of all that which has befallen this family of the misfortune, destruction and oppression is the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala together with his family members and companions. And that's why we ask Allah to make us among those who will take revenge alongside Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif from these oppressors and those who came after them and their followers and from those who were pleased with their wicked acts. This means that the one who is asking the Almighty Allah to let him be among the ones who are actually taking revenge together with the 12th Imam and his true companions knows how to be true servant, how to fulfill the responsibilities of a true servant. That's the only way he can have the chance to take revenge on those who move on their line and follow their way and are pleased with their deeds, the deeds of oppressing and actually wicked acts. And by this revenge, the Almighty Allah will cool the hearts of the community of believers and infuriate the hypocrites and the polytheists.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will God will come towards you.
Not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So when we talk about the praying for the triumph of revenge, one of the most clearest examples in this case is the advent of 12th Imam revenging for what happened to Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. This concept, the concept of praying for revenge has frequently appeared in the ziyarat of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and that of his son Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. An example of this is what has appeared in the lesser known ziyarah of Ashura, that we say, O Allah, make us among those who seek his revenge along with the just Imam, through whom you will make Islam and its followers mighty, O Lord of the worlds. But we have to take into our consideration that what happened in the Battle of Karbala, what happened, as we mentioned, in the Battle of Siffin, will actually happen. I mean, the stance between the two parties, between the right and the wrong, will happen in the time of the advent of Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, and we have to actually be ready for that. We are supposed to prepare ourselves for the time which we will be called to stand in one of the two sides. May the Almighty Allah help us to be among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States has bombed Syria more than 20,000 times over the past 8 years. The United States began bombing these ancient lands 30 years ago. The U.S. has continued bombing Iraq and neighboring countries on and off ever since. Each time, Americans have been told that doing so would protect American interests and help bring peace and stability to the region. Yet each period of airstrikes has brought more suffering, more violence, less security, and greater instability. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Robert Kohler, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. War Machine Doesn't Want Americans to Take War Personally. Here's more. For Washington, it seems that whatever the problem is, the answer is bombing. So wrote Stephen Zunes in the wake of Joe Biden's first act of murder as president. Oh, excuse me, his first act of defensive military action. bombing a border post in Syria, recently killing 22. This action, of course, will quickly be forgotten. The United States has bombed Syria more than 20,000 times over the past 8 years, Zunes noted, adding, "The United States began bombing these ancient lands 30 years ago. The U.S. has continued bombing Iraq and neighboring countries on and off ever since. Each time, Americans have been told that doing so would protect American interests and help bring peace and stability to the region. Yet, each period of airstrikes has brought more suffering, more violence, less security, and greater instability. It's called, usually with a shrug, endless war." When American citizens ponder this phenomenon, they are endlessly stunned and instantly immobilized. This is just how it is. American citizens devote $1 trillion or so a year to militarism. The god of war is their ruler, and the job of the guy they elect as president is to slather their every act of war in sophisticated justification, as known as public relations. George W. Bush gave U.S. citizens marching orders 2 decades ago, go shopping. For most Americans, war has simply been converted into a quiet abstraction, with the deaths of civilians conveniently shunted aside as collateral damage. War has nothing to do with them, except, of course, it does, at least in one way. The nature of war is to beget war, to magnify trouble, to make matters worse. War always comes home. The only way to interrupt the psychological and, of course, financial grip of the god of war has on the American government and much of its population is to shatter war's protective abstractions. Good violence is no better than bad violence. Our violence is no better than theirs. Murder is murder. Before we can talk about peace, release it from its simplistic abstraction. Can we all just get along and begin envisioning it, both individually and collectively, in all its overwhelming complexity? We believe we have to see acts of war for what they are, which is to say, see them the way the victims see them. We have to take them personally. But this is not the normal way of Western media, so we reach beyond the normal, quoting friend and longtime peace activist Kathy Kelly, who bleeds from the heart as she writes about 30 years of America-inflicted hell in the West Asia region, from the highway of death to the shock and awe bombing of Iraq to... Amiria was a Baghdad bunker to which hundreds of people had fled for safety during a U.S. bombing raid. What happened was two of U.S. smart bombs went through a ventilation shaft in the bunker, destroying it and killing over 400 people, mostly women and children. Many of them suffocated or burned to death as the temperature in the bunker became unimaginable. Not to worry, though. 30 years on, a U.S. general discussing the bombing with Al Jazeera said the bunker was thought to be a military commander center, explaining, "Civilian casualties happened. This was a legitimate military target. It was hit precisely. It was destroyed and put out of business, and there was very little collateral damage. You know, only 400 plus people." Kelly Rose, "I wish Joe Biden could meet the Pope in Iraq and ask him to hear his confession." This would be the beginning of peace, that is to say, the dawn of national awareness. by which women all of humanity face enormous dangers in the coming years, particularly related to climate change. They must be addressed. But no, we should not start nuking hurricanes. Real threats will not be solved, but they will certainly be amplified by U.S. militarism. However lacking Kari Kelly's imagined scenario in Baghdad, how do we begin transcending the nation's military mindset and the cash flow loop that makes it continually profitable to those in power? As Lindsay Khashoggian writes, the U.S. military reaches around the globe with approximately 800 foreign military installations in nearly half the world's countries and takes up more than half the discretionary budget that Congress allocates each year. Every decade or two, there is a new rationale for all this, with a new threat, unquote. Is Biden the president with the will and courage to begin standing up to this? American people must challenge him to be that president, channeling the voices of those who would do so if they could, the ones who died at Amiria in Baghdad and countless other targeted sites, including the Murrah Federal Building.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The qualities of the people of Azerbaijan that helped create the 29th of Behman event. When the people of Tabriz staged an uprising, in my opinion, this is an important point which should receive attention. They had already seen the 19th of Day event in Qom. Under such circumstances, the people entered the arena with a participation several times larger than what had occurred in Qom, and they introduced an innovative ceremony, the 40th day anniversary of the Qom incident. When other 40th day ceremonies were held, leading to those great popular movements, it all began in Tabriz. In other words, the people of Tabriz were the front runners for commemorating the martyrs before them. Well, it was their courage, piety, and zeal which brought them to the arena and created those great events. I believe that if it had not been for the valorous movement launched by the people of Tabriz on the 29th of Behman, the people of Qom's bloody movement might have been gradually consigned to oblivion, just like the 15th of Khordad of 1342, which was gradually being passed to oblivion. Of course, after the revolution, it was revived, but before the revolution, the people were gradually forgetting what had happened in Tehran, Qom, Varamin, and other cities on the 15th of Khordad of 1342.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The 19th of Day event by the people of Qom might also have suffered the same fate if the people of Tabriz had not entered the arena. However, the people created the 29th of Behman Valor, thus reviving the Qom incident and giving a fresh impetus to the revolutionary movement. Well, these three qualities, courage, zeal, and piety, showed themselves both during and after the revolution. In the beginning of the revolution, when foreigners were after disintegrating the country, the people of Tabriz entered the area. During the Sacred Defense era too, the Ashura army was a courageous and innovative army, and Shahid Bakri is also an unforgettable personality who will never be forgotten.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praise.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.